The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I'm Brenton Octagull, and I'll be filling in for Stephen Flory today. We're coming to you as I normally do when I take this program from Jerusalem, Israel. This week, we've had a pretty busy week over here. One of the highlights of my week was getting to go outside and lay down in the park with my 10-week-old daughter. It's been quite the experience having a baby over here in Israel and going through the medical system over here as well. But then being able to see this little baby grow has been just extremely wonderful. And it's interesting how connections can even be made through a baby such as it, little Adelaide. My wife doesn't have too many of her friends over here from back in the States. And our doula actually set up a meeting of sorts, or a date, you could say, between my wife and another a woman that just had her baby, another girl, about the same time a couple weeks back, and they got together and just discussed everything about babies. I wasn't there for that, and I wasn't that disappointed that I wasn't there for that one. But she has a husband, this other lady that my wife was having this baby date with, and they wanted to go out on a double date. So we actually did that this week. We went out in the evening to one of the local restaurants here, which was really nice. But then I learned about her husband, and we started talking, and my wife had already told me that he was the main correspondent, Jerusalem correspondent, for one of the major US TV broadcasters over here. So it was going to be interesting to talk to him. He works for a broadcaster in the U.S. that has got the reputation for left-wing bias, and indeed I think a lot of the reporting that gets shown on American TVs about Israel has that bias as well. So I was pretty interested to talk to him just about the whole process of how it works in the media, especially in a foreign office, especially in one such as Jerusalem. And I asked him what he reports on, who tells him what to report on, and he basically has quite a lot of freedom. I was quite surprised by to discuss and have stories on whatever he wants to. Of course, he has to pitch his stories to his editor, his boss over in Britain. He mainly does TV, but he does write as well. And then they normally get back to him and say that's okay. Now, one thing he did, or he was told when he came over here, initially about a year ago, was that the Israeli-Palestinian peace process was no longer going to be the main story in the United States. They've had a glut of it, it wasn't going anywhere, and he was told basically that that isn't going to be your main thrust, which I thought was interesting. But then he did relay to me kind of the frustration that he felt in a way, because even if he did feel that he had a powerful story about the political situation in Israel, it wouldn't get airtime in the United States because people in the United States do not care. According to his editors and according to the people, primetime TV in the United States, they don't want to hear about Israel. They don't want to hear about the Middle East. They want to hear about the United States. They want to hear about the Democratic Convention, the Republican Convention. They want to hear about Donald Trump. That's what gets air, because that's what the people want. So it's interesting that people do blame Western media for a lot of their reporting limited reporting on what they choose to cover, and say if only they covered other things. Well, the general population is what determines what a lot of what these programs will show. Now, of course, they can add their own bias. The people don't necessarily determine that, but they're going to show what gets the ratings. And because of that, a lot of what's happening in Israel falls by the wayside. So in light of that conversation, I just want to give you a couple of news stories from Israel before we get into the main topic that we were talking about as we will venture towards Europe later on in the program. So today I just went to a couple of Israeli news sites. The ones I normally go to are generally the ones without the left-wing bias, like Haaretz. That's got a kind of a left-wing bias. So I went to the Times of Israel. That's my first English source I go to each morning. And then I went to the Jerusalem Post, jpost.com, ynetnews.com. Israel Hayom is another one that you'll is a newer one. IsraelHayom.com, and then Israel National News. I go to those general sites each morning. Now, it's funny because I went to those sites, and what did I see even on Israeli, these Israeli sites? Well, the four top stories on Israel Hayom today were, one, Clinton accepts presidential nomination, highlights Israel's security, Iran deal. Two, Jewish Democrats press to get out the vote for Clinton. Three, at Democratic Confab, Derma touts Israel as bipartisan cause. And then for analysis, at DNC National Security Night, Israel is notable for its absence. So it's very interesting that even in Israeli politics, because of the large number of American Jews over here, that they are even focusing a lot on the American political situation. Of course, Israel is very close to America, at least it's been like that historically, and they are very concerned about who gets in power, who's going to be the next president of the United States, because it's going to determine a lot of the future relationship with Israel. Under the past 7.5 years of President Obama, it's very obvious that there has been a different tact taken by this administration away from Israel towards Israel's enemies in Iran, away from the historical allies of the United States. So Israel is concerned, obviously, about who the next president is going to be. Now, if you talk to Israelis on the street, a lot of them will are surprised by Donald Trump's rise, and they will talk about just how unrealistic that they thought this moment would be previously, that they thought that he would even get this far, yet he has surprised most people over the world, around the world, I believe, with that. But they're very opinionated in who they believe would be the best candidate for Israel. That is what they are concerned with most. And generally, Israeli Jews or American Jews have typically voted Democrat throughout history. So we'll see how it goes this time. But they seem to be fairly divided on the point. Okay, but getting to an actual story of something that has been taking place in the Middle East, and one thing that took place just this past week is, this article is from J Post, and it says, Prime Minister welcomes Cairo peace push, quote, there is much we can do together. So this week, Prime Minister Netanyahu, he hailed Egypt's regional role, saying that there was so much that they can accomplish together. He praised the president of Egypt right now, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, for what he has done to advance peace between Israel and the Palestinians. And just this week, he had an official reception at the Egyptian ambassador's home to mark Egypt's Independence Day. And there, he talked about the growing relationship between Israel and Egypt and why that's important. Here's a clip of what he said.
We welcome the efforts to advance peace by President Assisi, and we welcome the effort to incorporate other Arab states in this larger effort of a broader peace between all the peoples of the Middle East.
Now, it's interesting, as he concluded those comments there, that he talked about this region-wide effort that Israel has to push for closer ties with other states and other nations in the Middle East. And this is something we talked about on the Trumpet Hour on Wednesday with Joel Hilliker. And there's going to be an article that will be posted on Sunday on the Trumpet.com talking about this Arab outreach that Netanyahu has been leading for the past year and a half. It's really picking up steam. In the past month, we've had a number of different delegations from Saudi Arabia, from Egypt, as well. And then also we had the Turkey-Israel normalization of ties about a month before that. And it does seem that Israel is getting closer to a lot of these Sunni states. Of course, the reason this is happening is not necessarily because there's been a change of heart by the Arab populations in these nations towards Israel, but much rather the leadership of these nations are scared of the rise of Iran in the context of the withdrawal of the United States from the region. The United States is no longer the stabilizer of peace, or the stabilizer at least of the status quo in the Middle East that it used to be. And so they are being driven into the arms of one another, and these Arab states have been driven into Israel's arms and vice versa, to try and create some type of anti-Iranian alliance that could diminish Iran's power, at least hold onto the status quo. Now, this is what Dory Gold said just about what's happening over in this outreach. Dory Gold, he's the Director General of Israel's Foreign Ministry. He's Netanyahu's point man that's driving this outreach to the moderate Arab states. He said 20 or 30 years ago, everyone said solve the Palestinian issue and you'll have peace with the Arab world. Increasingly, we are becoming convinced that it is the exact opposite. It's a different order we have to create, and that's what we are going to do. Now, interestingly enough, on that dinner on Tuesday night, when I was talking with this journalist, he had come from a meeting that day with Dory Gold. And he talked about him being the driving force between this Arab outreach. And he talked about how much he would love to report on this story because it is a huge deal. It marks a drastic sea change from the status quo in the region, the fact that Israel and these Arab states look like they're getting along. And he said he would love to have done a story about it, but it would have never made the cut, according to at least his editors. People don't want to hear about this huge change that's being created in the Middle East because the United States is now supporting Iran instead of its traditional allies. So it wouldn't have made it onto TV in the US, so he didn't do a story on it. Now, Dory Gold asked him, apparently at the time, this is what he said, that he just asked what it would take for Netanyahu to get on a live shot back in the United States at the moment. And he joked that if Netanyahu was going to endorse a candidate, then he could do it there and then. So that's how even the prime minister is going to make his way into American television this time, if he endorsed a candidate, if he started talking about American politics. And obviously he wasn't going to do that. But we just, as I discussed with Joel Hilliker on Wednesday, this is a big change, what's happening in the Middle East with Israel's outreach. And many of them are calling this a positive change for the region. And indeed, it could look that way because Israel does need friends. It doesn't have much of a choice. And it will take friendship or at least alliance or temporary alliance with these nations in the meantime, as long as it looks to go forward according to their have their best foreign policy objectives in mind, then they'll do it. But it is very dangerous, these alliances with the Sunni Arab states. And you can read the article on Sunday if you like to read about why it's so dangerous. Now, the Jerusalem Post, they have another story today. Apparently the Palestinian Authority, led by Mahmoud Abbas, one of his ministers has urged the Arab League, that is a bunch of the different Arab states across the world, to help it sue Great Britain for the Balfour Declaration, which took place back in 1917, which helped pave the way for the establishment of the State of Israel. Now, this was the Palestinian Authority's foreign minister, Riyad al-Maliki. He said that he appealed to them to, quote, bring a suit against the British government over the ominous Balfour Declaration, which resulted in the Nabka, or catastrophe for the Palestinian people. And he told that to the Arab League. Now, the Balfour Declaration, most of you will probably know, that was authored by then UK Foreign Secretary Lord Arthur James Balfour, and it was signed in 1917. And it basically pledged British support for the establishment of a Jewish national homeland in what was then Ottoman-ruled Palestine. So the Palestinians, they weren't obviously a nation yet. A lot of the Palestinians hadn't even historically hadn't even arrived yet, since they came, well, they were starting to come from different parts of the Arab world then, as in search of good paying jobs from the Jewish people that had started to buy up land there. Anyhow, this 1917 declaration kind of underpins the international support that Israel had, even before World War II, to create a homeland. People naturally assume that the Israeli state was a creation that was motivated purely by the Holocaust, and that the Jews needed a homeland to be safe from these type of atrocities that had taken place historically throughout the world. And yet it wasn't. That, of course, added to the motivation of it eventually, and probably swayed a lot of public opinion. But the move to establish a homeland in Israel, in the traditional homeland of the Jews, really started being pushed 50, 60 years before that. Dory Gold had a comment about this, and he said, quote, this is a statement from Dory Gold about what the Palestinian Authority wants to do about suing Britain over their role in the Balfour Declaration. He says, quote, "The obvious lack of any legal basis for Abbas's claim demonstrates yet again the continuing refusal of the Palestinian side to recognize the legitimate and indigenous connection to the land, to the Jewish people have to its ancient homeland, alongside the recognition the Palestinians seek for their own rights." So he's basically saying this just proves once again that if they're going to sue the British for allowing the Israelis or the Jews to be here, then obviously they don't even accept the Jewish right to be here at all, which you would think would be the basis for two states for two people, which is what they claim they want. And yet to this day, they haven't recognized the Jewish nation's right to exist. Now, finally, there is another story here. I don't actually think they're going to be successful in suing the British government for something they did 100 years ago, but we'll see. Finally, there was one other story here in Jerusalem Post, and that is titled, "Police Face Tough Time Recruiting New Officers in Jerusalem." Now, surprise, surprise, this is a story, but I'll just read the first few paragraphs of it. It says, "Nearly a year into an unpredictable terror wave that has sporadically engulfed the capital, necessitating extraordinary security measures, the Israeli police is struggling to enlist 1,200 recruits to serve in Jerusalem, in addition to the 3,500 officers presently on the ground." Now, Channel 10 reported this week that only 200 recruits of that 1,200 had agreed to be stationed in Jerusalem, despite a recruitment campaign offering extra benefits due to the pronounced dangers and challenges inherent in patrolling the volatile capital. So it seems pretty obvious that they're going to find it difficult to get new police officers to join the force in Jerusalem when they are randomly attacked, randomly mowed down in different parts of the city. And the police spokesman, Mickey Rosenfield, said this, quote, "An officer who goes on a horse patrol shift on the beach in Herzliya, which is near Tel Aviv, looking for petty crime or stolen water bottles from a bag, faces far different challenges than an officer having petrol bombs thrown at him while patrolling through Silwan or Isawiya in East Jerusalem. So you have to put that in perspective." So that is definitely true. I mean, the Jerusalem police force, they face a lot of challenges other police forces in the world haven't to this point. And yet, even what we're seeing in Europe, things look to be changing there for the difficulty the police are going to have in keeping the terrorist population, or the Arab population, at bay in the near future. So there are just a few of the stories from Jerusalem this past week. I might do that each time I take this show, just to ensure that we are getting a little bit of news out of this country, around the world. This program, as Stephen Fleury talks about, has got a worldwide audience, and a lot of people do tune in. So I hope to provide a couple of stories for you like that in the future. Well, when we come back, we're going to shift our attention away from Israel and to Europe. So we'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I'm Brent Nuchtigal once again, filling in for Stephen Flurry and coming to you from Jerusalem, Israel. Well, the sounds that you were hearing just then were that of Pope Francis entering into a church in Poland on Wednesday. Now, he arrived on Wednesday and he'll be there through the weekend to celebrate World Youth Day, an annual event that takes place around the world. And yesterday, the Pope gave a mass to an audience of 500,000 people, which speaks to the support the Catholic Church has in Poland. Poland is one of the most Catholic parts of Europe, with about 98% of its population of 38 million declaring themselves followers of the Catholic faith. And it's interesting that his Polish visit comes at a really critical time in the world, and especially for Europe, and that's what we're going to talk more about today in the main part of this program. Now, this has been discussed a little bit here by Stephen Flurry, talking about the Pope's comments about while on Tuesday when he was talking about how we are in a war, and yet this isn't a religious war, which is very interesting because I'm sure there were probably people throughout Europe wanting him to admit the obvious that this is a very much a religious war that's taking place all over the Middle East. And Stephen Flurry talked about that quite a lot, Middle East and the world. And he talked about in the Middle East just how the migration away from there, how the heavy numbers leaving the Middle East have been Christians, and he went through different countries discussing just how many have left in the past 5 years. Quite dramatic. So you can go back and listen to that another time. Well, right now we know that Europe is in an uproar, and they've got the immigration crisis that's threatening to change the whole historical nature of Europe, and it's also leading to, it seems, a lot of these terrorist acts around Germany, France as well. Then we just had Brexit, which no one really knows how that's going to impact Europe as well. And then following on the heels of that, or even preceding that and causing part of that, was the rise of nationalism in states in Europe. Now, Europe at this time is searching for answers of how to go forward. And really, that's why I believe this visit by the Pope is very significant and could be significant. It's deeply symbolic as well, as the Pope is visiting Poland. The memory of Pope John Paul II really does hang over him. There has been, in a good way, you could say, but also in kind of a way that we'll get to as well as we go, that maybe Europe is, and even the Poles, are wanting a little bit more of a reaction from the Pope towards what's going on in Europe. Well, like I said, that Poland was incredibly important in the life of Pope John Paul. He was a Pole. He grew up there. He was trained there. That's where he was stationed before he became the Pope. He was the actual founder of World Youth Day as well. But Pope John Paul II was famous for something so much more geopolitical. He was famous for more than just rallying Catholic unity. He was famous for really rallying European unity as well. Now, I want to quote from an article at length here. It's written by one of our trumpet writers, Jeremiah Jacques. He wrote it a couple of years ago, and it details the history of Pope John Paul II and some of the critical history that he was involved in, particularly in terms of bringing down, starting the motivation to bring down the Berlin Wall, starting to bring down or take down the, or bring up, I guess you could say, the Iron Curtain over Eastern Europe. And I'd like to read that at length. It's written by Jeremiah Jacques, as I was saying, and he's a very good poetic writer, so I don't feel that you'll be annoyed that I'm reading, if I stay true to his prose. He writes, in early 1979, and just at the beginning, before I get into this quote, I want you to just think about this quote in the terms of, in the context of what Europe faces right now and what Pope Francis faces right now as well as he is visiting Poland. This is what Mr. Jacques wrote. In early 1979, Eastern Europe seemed as firmly clenched in the Soviet grip as ever. Agriculture was collectivized. Private shopkeepers had been almost completely replaced by gigantic government-controlled conglomerates. All official education programs were gutted to conform to Marxist-Leninist views. All works of literature and art presented to the public were in line with the voice of the communists. Many churches were torn down by armies of secret police, and religion was actively suppressed. So that just gives you the snapshot of what Poland was like in early 1979. He continues, Warsaw was among the most stifled of the Eastern Bloc cities. Quote, it was the everyday grayness of life without hope, just survival, said Jan Prokop, a professor of Polish literature who lived there at the time. But then by that June, the grayness of the Polish capital began to give way to something else. Windows in the sterile Stalin-era shops and apartment buildings began springing to life with festive shrines, crucifixes, flowers, rosaries, and depictions of Mary and Jesus. These shrines were intended to welcome one of Poland's own, whom the communist government had reluctantly allowed permission to visit, John Paul II. He continues, despite government efforts to minimize the crowds, an estimated 10 million Poles, almost one-third of the nation, turned out to see the 59-year-old Pope. Almost all of those who were unable to attend one of his numerous outdoor masses followed his nine-day, six-city pilgrimage on television or radio. The message of the Pope delivered was a highly emotional one. Quote, I cry, from all the depths of this millennium, let your spirit descend. Let your spirit descend and renew the face of the earth, the face of this land, he publicly prayed. He spoke candidly to his countrymen, quote, you must be strong with the strength of faith. When we are strong with the Spirit of God, we are also strong with faith in man. There is, therefore, no need to fear, end quote. The message resonated deeply in the hearts of the Polish people. We want God! We want God! Would often erupt from the crowds for minutes on end. The emboldened people pushed their fear of the government aside by chanting for the antithesis of communism. They were calling an end to the ruling regime. Then Mr. Jacques continues, in August 1980, 14 months after John Paul II's visit to Poland, a workers' strike broke out. The strike gave birth to Poland's Solidarity Movement, the first free trade union in the Soviet bloc. The Solidarity Movement was a non-violent workers' rights crusade, but was fueled by the spirit of Catholicism. It terrified the communists, showing them that Poland's Catholic heritage could resurface after years of suppression. Quoting theologian Michael Novak, Mr. Jacques continues, quote, "The power of the papacy was never more visible. And the Soviets learned this to their dismay. The Pope could turn their empire inside out," end quote. Then Mr. Jacques continues, "The communists fought hard against Solidarity. They implemented martial law, arrested thousands of and interned hundreds. In December 1981, the leader of the Polish Communist Party ordered troops and tanks to move on his own people. The communists clamped down, all but extinguished the Solidarity movement. But back in Rome, John Paul II remained firmly committed to the cause. He wrote several letters to Soviet leaders, joined his voice with that of the anti-Soviet president of the United States, and prayed publicly and frequently for the success of the Solidarity movement. Then, in late 1982, he issued this declaration to Europe. Quote, "Find yourself again. Be yourself. Discover your origins, revive your roots. Return to those authentic values which made your history a glorious one and your presence so beneficent in the other continents. Rebuild your spiritual unity. You can still be the guiding light of civilization," end quote. The next year, in this charged and dangerous climate, John Paul traveled to Poland again. Since the communists had inflicted such damage on Solidarity, they expected the pontiff to be prepared to compromise, but he was in no such mood. With most of Poland watching on television, John Paul raised his voice and lectured the leader of the Communist Party. Quote, "History will be your judge," the pontiff said, and he demanded that union rights be restored to Solidarity. In an interview years later, the leader of the Communist Party in Poland spoke about the fear he felt and his visible knees shaking. They clearly captured that on national televised footage. Quote, "Those were the classic, cliched, trembling knees in front of something I knew was extremely powerful," he said. In the face of John Paul's demand, the Communist Party leader capitulated. The Vatican-funded Catholic Solidarity movement triumphed, and Poland broke the communist yoke. The efforts sent shockwaves rippling through the Soviet Union, from Budapest to Eastern Russia. These convulsions eventually toppled the Berlin Wall in 1989, led to the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991, and routed communist influence from Eastern Europe. Mr. Jacques continues, "Other factors and people contributed to the demise of communism, but historians and analysts almost unanimously agree that it was Pope John Paul II who played the greatest role." ABC correspondent Bill Blakemore reported this, quote, "Not only had John Paul II ignited a nonviolent revolution when he first returned as Pope in 1979, but by 1989 he had guided it with patient force till it won. The Polish Solidarity movement spread until the Berlin Wall came down and the communists went away." Now, Soviet Premier Gorbachev wrote in 1999 about John Paul's approach. He said, it, quote, "made a new kind of thinking possible for us all." Then historian George Weigel said, quote, "The 9 days of John Paul II in June 1979 were 9 days on which the history of the 20th century turned a dramatic way," end quote. This dramatic turn paved the way for Poland and many former Eastern Bloc nations, Romania, Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Estonia, Hungary, Latvia, Lithuania, Slovakia, and Croatia, to join the European Union. Europe's East and West had been united. Now, certainly when that happened, where the Berlin Wall fell down, this is something that was deeply significant for those that had been a part of the work of Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong, that had been listening to him for years on the radio. And for 50 years, he was talking about how this was going to happen. And it was right there before everybody's eyes. East and West Europe had become one once again. Now, while Mr. Armstrong didn't live to see that day, he certainly did comment on the progress that was being made, and made specifically by Pope John Paul II. A short time after his first visit to Poland in 1980, Mr. Armstrong wrote this. He said the character, personality, and actions of the Polish Pope, John Paul II, indicate more than possibly that he may be the Pope to offer his good services to unite the nations of Europe once again. European nations want, seriously, to be united. Of themselves, they are unable. John Paul II could make it possible. Now, indeed, John Paul II did do a lot. I've finished the quote from Mr. Armstrong. They did do a lot. He did a lot, as we saw, to bring down the Berlin Wall, to get rid of communism out of Eastern Europe, to allow one unified Europe to spring forth. Now, since 1989, Europe has gotten closer, and we've been talking about this for decades, showing you how it's become closer. But there's still more to do. There is still more unification needed. It's not all done. John Paul did make a lot of that possible, but it's not finished yet. So why go through all this history that I've already covered about John Paul II and his visit to Poland and how that started a decade-long project to bring down the Berlin Wall, to end communism in Eastern Europe? Well, I went through that history to show what can happen if a pope is vocal towards unification of Europe. And while a pope is in Poland, no less. And we have a pope in Poland right now. Now, I don't feel like Francis at this time is going to give a type of revive your roots or revive your history, look back to your roots speech to the Europeans. Although, what if he did? What if a pope would be bold enough to say that today? Would Europe's response be as Poland's was back in 1979 and through the 80s? Would it be unifying for the European superstate to have such a pope come out for unification of the European Union, and even towards a full political union? Now, that is what we expect to happen eventually. It's something that Mr. Armstrong prophesied in the response, really, or right after the speech that John Paul II gave in Poland when he was there. He wrote this in 1980. This is in a co-worker letter. Right after 1979, he said, "The politicians cannot unite Europe by themselves. They can't do it. They can't do it. They've wanted it, but they cannot do it." Then he continues, "Only with the collaboration of the Pope can they do it." Isn't that amazing? We have all these crises converging on Europe, and you would think that they have the motivation and the political tools to unite further. And as they are getting closer, we also know that they cannot achieve full political union without the midwifery of the Catholic Church, without the power that the Catholic Church can give towards that cause. And that's what Mr. Armstrong said. Here's another clip of Mr. Armstrong saying as much in a message to the Worldwide Church of God in 1982.
Now, many of the political leaders, while they want a political union in Europe, they have all these things to overcome, the various languages, different nationalities, different patriotisms, everything of that kind, but then the religion is divided. Now, many of the leaders, the political leaders over there, don't want religion to have anything to do with it. They'd rather religion would stay out. But they cannot bring themselves together. And the Pope at Rome knows that, and he made that very plain in his recent trip to Spain.
So Mr. Armstrong was saying there in 1982 that even though that the political leaders wanted unification, a full political union, they couldn't bring it about fast enough, and it would only take, would have to take the Pope, the Catholic Church, to bring that unity around. And we just witnessed through the 1980s, 1979 onwards, how Pope John Paul brought a certain European unity. He brought Europe together by helping collapse the Soviet Union. in Eastern Europe. Now, there is a powerful documentary that came out just this year on this very subject. I haven't watched it yet. I've just watched the trailer. I want to watch it, and hopefully I can soon enough. But it discusses this at length, the power of John Paul II in unifying Europe. Now, the current Pope that we have, he just received this year the Charlemagne Prize. Now, this is a prize that is given each year for those who perform exceptional work in the service of European unity. And this prize itself, it's normally given in the capital city of Charlemagne in Germany, but this time it was given in Rome in a pretty special departure from the tradition. Now, the committee in choosing Pope Francis said that, quote, Europe has gone through 7 years of weaknesses, crises, and setbacks, causing a dramatic loss of confidence. In these times in which many citizens in Europe seek orientation, the Pope sends a message of love and encouragement, he says. The website says, again, this is who awarded the reason, the rationale behind awarding Pope Francis with this award. It said, quote, the recipients are those who most often work towards integration and who are able to exercise a political influence. Now, Pope, interestingly enough, Pope John Paul II, he was the first pope to win the Charlemagne Prize, and that was awarded to him just before his death in 2005, and it was focused on his role in defeating communism, as we've covered. The Economist magazine wrote this about Pope Francis and his selection this past year. Quote, the selectors are adamant that Pope Francis, more than anybody else, has breathed new life into the construction of Europe at a time when that effort was sagging. So there, this past year, a few months ago, in a cathedral in Rome, European leaders gathered to give praise and honor to the Pope, the very Pope that's in Poland right now, retracing a lot of the footsteps that Pope John Paul II did back in the late 70s. So they were gathered there in this to witness this ceremony. Mario Draghi, the president of the European Central Bank, was there. Angela Merkel was there. Jean-Claude Juncker was there, the president of the European Parliament. Martin Schulz, the president of the Council of the European Union, was there. Donald Tusk as well, the president of the European Council, was there, all to witness this ceremony. This is what Donald Tusk said at that ceremony when he broke, finally, into English.
We were and will be Europeans. I would not like this to be just a statement of geographical nature, nor an exclusively political declaration. It is also, and perhaps foremost, a statement of axiology and metaphysics. In a sense, Europe is an article of faith. Why should we be proud of Europe? Why is it worth our concern and, if need be, our protection and defense? It is because the spirit of love and freedom is still present here. Please forgive me the perhaps exaggerated phrase, but let the solemn character of this ceremony be my excuse. We can be proud of Europe because, Holy Father, Europe still resembles you. If it stops resembling you, it will be reduced to a mere geographical term and a political void. Simply speaking, Holy Father, you are the Pope of hope for all of us. Thank you.
You are the Pope that unites all of us. That's what Donald Tusk just said in that quote. And where's he from? He's from Poland. And surely he's wondering, as a lot of other people are probably wondering in Europe, as they look at Pope Francis, trace a lot of the steps that John Paul II did when he celebrated the first World Youth Day there in Poland. They're probably asking, can this Pope do the same thing? Or maybe they're asking, where is the Pope in giving his voice more to European unification? Whether Francis will be like John Paul II or not, time will tell. But the Catholic Church most definitely will be the glue that brings Europe together. As Mr. Armstrong said in those quotes earlier, it can only happen through the help of the Catholic Church. Why is that? Because as he said, they come from different ethnicities. They speak different languages. The thing that they share, that the Europeans share, is their European Catholic heritage. That is the thing that will bring them together. Stephen Flurry this week, he quoted from a Bret Stephens piece from the Wall Street Journal, and it was entitled, Is Europe Helpless? But the very end of it's very interesting because it talks about the question of which of how Europe is going to be able to survive the current crises. He writes, can the decline be stopped? Can European decline be stopped? Will it fracture? He says it can be. I'll continue the quote. Yes, it can be stopped, but that would require a great unlearning of the political mythologies on which modern Europe was built. And then he talks about these mythologies. One, that the European Union is the result of a post-war moral commitment to peace. No, that didn't do it. What is his second myth that he needs to that needs to be removed from European thinking if they're going to not decline? He says that Christianity is of merely historical importance to European identity. They have to get that out of their heads, that Christianity is of merely historical importance to the European identity. It's not merely historical. Of historical importance to European identity. It is important currently. Stop kidding yourself, he's writing to Europe. Christianity isn't merely important to Europe's historical identity. It's important to Europe's current identity. If you look at the empires of the past, tolerance or multiculturalism, they're not a rallying cry. That will not be strong enough to be the glue that holds together an empire. It needs to be something more than that and something that they share. Then he writes, people who believe in nothing, including themselves, will ultimately submit to nothing. Then he writes, more importantly, Europeans will have to learn that powerlessness can be as corrupting as power and much more dangerous. The storm of terror that is descending on Europe will not end in some new politics of inclusion, community outreach, more foreign aid, or musings of Miss Merkel. It will end in rivers of blood, theirs or yours. So it's not going to end well for somebody. You can't just talk this away, what's happening in Europe, he's saying. So how will they become unified? Well, I think it's very interesting at where he goes for the solution. He says, in all of this, the best guide to how Europe can find its way to safety is the current country it has spent the best part of the last 50 years lecturing and vilifying, Israel. For now, it's the only country in the West that refuses to risk the safety of its citizens on someone else's notion of human rights or the altar of peace. But notice why they need to look to Israel that he gets to. It's not because of their superior technology or things like that in the way that they counter peace. He writes, Europeans will no doubt look to Israel for tactical tips in the battle against terrorism, crowd management techniques, and so on. But what they really need to learn from the Jewish state is the moral lesson. What is that lesson? Namely, that identity can be a great preserver of liberty, and that free societies cannot survive through progressive accommodations to barbarians. That's how he ends it, saying that it's identity that is the only thing that can, or knowing your identity, preserve your society. Basically, he's saying, Europe, you need to find your identity. What is it? What is Europe's identity? And I've learned this well from being in Israel as well. Because when we think of a lot of Europe right now is not Catholic. A lot of Europe is secular. A lot of Europe doesn't even believe in God. So how could the Catholic Church rally them? Well, look at Israel. A lot of Israelis are not religious. But regardless, they are Jewish. Jewishness is their history. And they will rally around that history. They will fight for that history. That is their identity. They know who they are as a people, regardless of whether they're religious or not. Now with Europe, what is their history? Not all of them right now are religious Catholics. Secularism has taken over there as well, as it's taken over in Israel. And yet Israelis have something to fight for. okay, yes, they're all in the same nation, so they're fighting for their nation's right to exist. Well, you could say that, but you also could recognize, why did they come in the first place? Why did Jews from all over the world, from Russia, from Spain, from Morocco, from Ethiopia, America, Britain, Eastern Europe, from France, how can they all come with different nationalities, as the Europeans have right now, different nationalities, and fight for their new nation? It's because they're fighting for their identity as Jews. That is in their collective history. Their collective Jewish history transcends the nations that they have come from. Now, Europeans will never fight for Europe. They will never unite under a European flag unless they see that their history transcends their national borders. And what is that history that they share? It's the history of the Catholic Church. It's their common ground. Whether they're religiously Catholic or not, that doesn't matter. That's still their identity. And that's why only the Catholic Church can unify Europe. It is time for nationalism of the individual state to be transferred to nationalism of the spirit. It's the only way it's going to work. That's why it takes more than just a strong man and a strong leader to unite Europe. It's going to also have to take a pope. A pope that is once again, as John Paul II was able to tell all Europeans, stand up. Remember your roots. Remember your shared history. That's your identity. And as of right now, all the eyes are on Pope Francis as he tours Poland, where a pope of another era did exactly that. Now, surely some people can come together and put two and two together in Europe and realize that it was a lot to do, had a lot to do with the power that the Catholic Church had and of the Pope to unify Europe once before. Surely they see that that is needed once again. That's what Brett Stevens is saying. You have to do away with the fallacy that Catholicism was only important to your historic identity and not your current identity. It is still important if you want to be unified. That's why Mr. Armstrong saw it as well. He saw that unity could only come to Europe through the Catholic intervention. And he prophesied that that would definitely come. Now, time will tell whether this will be the Pope to do it or not. That's it today for the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, coming to you today from Jerusalem, Israel. If you would like to send some feedback to Stephen Fleury, you can do that by emailing td@kpcg.fm. From Jerusalem, have a wonderful weekend.